first, as always, on Tuesday, Colin Fleming joins us on the telephone line. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Mr. Kimball?
Well, I'm getting ready for Halloween. The boy is going to be a giant piece of candy corn, and I wanted to be some other candy, but I got handed the duty of answering the door and handing out the candy to people.
So you're going costumeless?
Well, you know, I want to wear a costume, but I've done that a few times in the past, and generally people seem a bit freaked out by that. I don't know why.
Wow, when I asked you that question, it almost made it sound if you were a nudist. That would be a good way for a guy like
that. They really get freaked out by that. I think they put you on a list for that.
Maine is a very, it's a state of the free, though, right? Everyone does their own thing up there.
It is,
right?
Yes. But when it comes to answering your door, some little sense of modesty is always appropriate, I believe.
Yes, I am sure you will pull it off, as you do with everything, with aplomb.
Aplomb and perhaps a dash of panache. But that's not what we're here for today.
Candy corn? Does he actually, is that like a preferred candy of his? Because it seems kind of like a throwback to like 1970s. Like it's more decorative, I would think, than tasty, right?
He loves candy corn. If he could have candy corn for dinner, he would eat it.
Okay, so like when I got candy corn as a kid, when we went door to door, it was kind of like, oh man, like, and it sounds like here's a handful of the corn. And you're like, really? Maybe we could do one of the big Twixes. And they're like, no, I have another handful of the corn.
More
so,
candy
oh,
corn.
Well, each his own.
I was never a huge fan. I myself like the now politically incorrect Indian corn.
Is it, you mean like in terms of the decorative corn, right? Not allowed to call it that anymore?
Yeah, well, you know, the candy corn is, you know, the yellow and orange and white. The candy corn had the darker shades.
Yeah, it was a brown, chocolatey flavor at the bottom, and I think orange and yellow were included.
Yes.
Well, you say that, like, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, though, in terms of, like, pure Halloween-centric, perfect, endemic to Halloween candy is, like, right on the nose, the color scheme. Everything about it to me just says Halloween. So I had like seven of them last night, and then I felt ill, and it just was not really what I was looking for. I was knocking them back, man. I was really like, oh, we'll just do a few more climbs tomorrow.
Reese's is the gold standard. I'm with you on that. But we want to talk about films today. We've talked horror films with you, but this time around, we want to talk about some that may have slipped through the cracks that the average film viewer may not be aware of, and I want to start with one of the strangest films of all time, and one of the creepiest. And I've never seen the whole thing, but I need to. A silent film from Sweden from 1922 that's just about the freakiest thing you could ever take in.
True, this would be Hacksan, which just came out in a Blu-ray version from Criterion. And I like when these early films, these silent films, get that treatment because it's easy for them to be overlooked there, just like a lot of people who watch movies have never seen films like this. And they're something along these lines that's in the public domain. It's not hard for you to see. And there's a nice copy, too, on YouTube for anyone who wants to check it out. But the premise of this film is it's a documentary, in theory, is really what it is, with these cutaways to dramatic scenes, and it looks at witchcraft throughout the ages. The director was a guy named Benjamin Christensen, and what he's really doing, fascinating to look at now, is bizarre as some of this film is. It has some of the most haunting imagery you will ever see. It's a nightmare maker. It's nightmare fuel.
Oh, it sure is.
Celluloid form. And it's about witches and how witches are hunted throughout the ages and how we mount these witch hunts. You watch it now and you think, there's kind of a lot of overlap there. And there are these themes of mental illness, and you would have looked at something like the internet and been like, yeah, like this was what my film was anticipating. Now, you also get probably the most famous image, which doesn't make it a famous image in and of itself because it's not a very well-known film, from the film involves the devil, played by our director himself, with, it's a butter churn between his legs. Okay, but it doesn't look like a butter churn when you see the film, and the devil he'd be going to town on the devil. He's doing it right in front of me. He's like, oh, man. I am glad my television or whatever, if I'm watching this on, is not three-dimensional, because I would get spurted on any moment. And the devil's like, yeah, you like what you're watching. Wow, this is really, it's potent. And it's, again, it's just one image after another. It's like an iron of horror pressing into your brain, like seared. And it's in four parts, and it really dissects this notion of mental illness and witchcraft. And in the end, it says, we don't really have witches anymore, but it's been replaced by, like, how unwell everybody is. It's like, hello, 1922, 2019.
Well, let's move ahead to the late 1950s. I'd just about love anything that stars Dana Andrews. Fill us in on Curse of the Demon.
Dana Andrews, who we've talked about in this program before, he's not someone you'd really expect to see in a British horror film, is he? He is such an American character actor who could also do leading roles. And Night of the Demon is based upon an M.R. James ghost story called Casting the Runes, which is a great title for a story. Casting, the verb meaning to take something, a small object, stick it on somebody's person, and have it be disseminated that way. A rune being this piece of paper that has a cipher on it that is going to set you up for some bad, bad mojo. And it's directed by Jacques Tourneur, who really traversed a lot of ground. He is our man behind Out of the Past, the 1947 film noir with Robert Mitchum. He is the director, one of the three main directors in the Val Luden stable of auteurs who work hand-in-hand with Luden as the producer. In Night of the Demon, what Tourneur did not want to have happen in the film was for there to be this monster. Now, anyone out there, when we're done, go online, go on Google, type in the name of this film, hit Google Images, and you will see the monster. If you haven't seen the film, it's going to be this just like, wow, kind of moment for you, because it is the coolest-looking monster you will ever see. It is as close as I think I've ever seen in a horror film to what an actual demonic giant presence would look like. And it's what you'd expect from Tourneur in the sense that it's unexpected. There are film noir elements. There are these creepy Edwardian horror story vibes. And there is a guy who is presiding over a satanic cult. Actually, Orson Welles would have been perfect in that role. He must have been off doing something else. And you have COVID, you have all the stuff going on at once within this realm, too, of the antiquarian. These old books and messing around in things that maybe you shouldn't be messing around in.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about some unjustly overlooked horror films. Eyes Without a Face from 1960. It's not just a Billy Idol song.
No, it's not. If you do type it in on Google, though, you will get a lot of Billy Idol. It is a film by, it's a French film, well, it's mostly a French film, by Georges Franju. And it is really twofold. It is a gore film. It is a film that, it's not hostile gore, so don't think it's going to be something like that. But I never understood when people, like, with, for Halloween viewing parties, they'd be like, yeah, hostile! Slumber Party Massacre! Like, slasher films normally are not Halloween films. They're a different kind of film that you watch, I don't know, on Friday the 13th. You have a marathon of those films. But there is a caveat to that. And I would say that the difference maker with this particular film is how highly poeticized it is. A good Halloween film, I'd say a good horror film, has a dreamlike quality to it for whatever realistic overtones it possesses. And this is very much in a Jean Cocteau, Beauty and the Beast type of mold. You have a guy, he's a doctor, film starts with a female corpse being thrown into like a rivery ditch, and that's just this corpse that this guy threw away because he faked his daughter's disappearance. Her face is deformed. Our scientist deformed it by a car crash that he had when she was in the car with him. And so he's trying to do a face transplant. And you know how well those go. So, of course, he's collecting everything he can collect. He's like, you know what? These people, their faces really are not adapting to my daughter's face. I will get some German shepherds and experiment with them. That'll make things go well. In the end, the daughter feels ostracized. She ends up going out, and the man's critters, National Cat Day, everybody, they turn on him, and it's like this Lugosi House of Pain type of thing from a 1930s Universal horror. But it's a beautiful film. There are beautiful tracking shots, and it's like, wow, this is a kind of poetry, a poem come to life, again, in celluloid form.
From 1957, a film that I've only seen once, and it's been a while, but I love it because it's got a couple of my favorite character actors who you might not expect to see in a film called The Vampire, Dabbs Greer and Paul Breuniger, known for Rawhide and a lot of Western work.
Sure, and this is right in the pocket of that Western Rawhide era. And you have this melange with this film. It's quite a bit different. Obviously, vampire films had, by 1957 were pretty passe. They weren't exactly a rare commodity in cinema, or at the time on radio or television. But what we have here is a pseudo-Drac type of story meets a sci-fi element. Sci-fi was the ruling outre genre, I would say, more so than horror of the 1950s. At the end of the 1950s, which is when we're at right now, horror is reasserting itself. But up until this point, what terror we've had in the 1950s has been overspill from sci-fi. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Sure, it's terrifying, but it's mostly terrifying because of the ideas. The main motor of a film like that is the sci-fi element. The vampire involves a guy, a research scientist, and he happens upon someone else's research materials, a guy who just died, he's experimenting with vampire bat saliva and whatnot. He has these blackouts. This guy has come along and discovered this other man's research, and it turns out he's going all vampire rogue, but he doesn't know it. Now, that's a trope that you would get in horror fiction, too, from the 1890s to the 1920s. People committing these crimes. It's a little bit of something left over from the whole Jekyll and Hyde archetype. Jekyll and Hyde, all of that happens. It's like, oh, no, what did I do last night? Oh, where was I? Like, you don't know. So it kind of takes you off the hook of culpability. And it's also this naturalistic, out-in-the-woods horror film. And you don't get a lot of vampire films where you're seeing pine trees. And it's not a bad guy who's at the heart of it. And you can argue that Dracula is not a bad guy in those films, in that novel. He doesn't really want to be Dracula. But this guy has a Lon Chaney type of vibe to him, where it's like, please, just kill me. Make this end. I didn't mean for any of this to happen. My bad, bros. Take him out in the end. Well, you knew he was going to. I got a record for you.
The next film was a TV film, I believe, originally, and I think I remember seeing this when it came out in 1981, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow with Charles Durning.
Yes, and a very sweaty Durning in it. He is just like, do you enjoy how large my pores are and how much flows from them? Wow, that's pretty impressive, guys. And it's for 1981. But it does have, as someone had mentioned to me today, quite a 1970s feel to it. You'd be like, well, that's just a couple of years earlier. It's just like, whatever, 1973, it's less than a decade ago. And it's like, well, yeah, that's true. But you have to realize that come 1980, come 1981, we're getting into the slasher genre, where that removed from Halloween, which is 1978, the John Carpenter film. And again, it's that overspill. It's going to be the recreation of that original premise in various forms. My Bloody Valentine, things of that nature. This is not, even though I guess you could say it's a slasher film, it is quite an artful slasher film. And I think it's the best Scarecrow film ever made. You'd be like, well, how many could there be? It's actually like this entire subgenre of horror based around scarecrows. Like, they're not uncommon. I think you could even argue, too, that when you first meet The Scarecrow and The Wizard of Oz, another horror film from a different perspective, kind of a scary moment in a succession of scary moments. This film holds up wonderfully well. It's surprisingly well, because what was happening at the end of the 70s and the early 80s, you would get these made-for-TV horror films that, I swear, they're better films than Get Out or Us. If you look at how a film like Get Us is made, how it holds together cinematically. A film like this particular movie beats the bag out of it. And it was just something you were supposed to see on whatever night it was. Sunday, you have pedophilia in this. You have all forms of molestation. You have the notion of idiots, which sounds like an offensive term now, but it was riffing off of something like Browning's Freaks from the early 1930s. So there was a lot in this particular Selma Gundy.
And then finally, we go back to the 1930s for a stop animation film that I have not seen called The Mascot.
Also available on YouTube. And this is, I don't know if it's not the quintessential Halloween horror film. It is not outright on the face of it a horror film. And yet, I think that's why it works so well as one. Because what really terrifies us in life is when we're going along in our day, and it's like, here is this thing you now have to contend with. That is the root, or that is the most fundamentally human root of, I wouldn't even say horror. I'd say that's terror. There's a difference between horror and terror. Terror is more potent, always. Boris Karloff noted that difference, and it's something we see in this film. It's about this kid, he's poor, and he's saying to his mother that he would like an orange. And the mother says, no, we can't afford an orange. And he is Frankenstein together out of scraps of stuffed animals, this stuffed animal bear. And the bear overhears this. And the bear says, huh, I can remedy this situation. I'm going to go out and score an orange for this kid. Bear goes out, and boy, does he have a Faustian time. He ends up as a hood ornament, and it looks like he's hanging like Billy Holiday's strange fruit. It's like, damn, that's not the way this was supposed to go. Ends up in a toy shop. And at this coven, at this devil's convention, essentially, and you have Satan in this one. He's like, ditch the butter churn. It's my refractory period. I'm here for this. Let's do it. And he leads this horrible kind of like, but cute at the same time. It's like, man, maybe the devil's not such a bad dude. And all to get this orange. And he sits together. Everybody sits together. It's stop motion animation. And it was so pioneering. This is 1933. It's the first wave of that classic horror period with Dracula in 31, along with Frankenstein. And it just doesn't look like any other movie you will ever see. You'll see others that are in its footsteps, but still, this is such a archetype maker. And I watch it. You can watch it on YouTube. I watch it every year, and it's just terrifying. It's pure cinematic terror.
I have to check it out indeed. Colin Fleming joining us to talk about some overlooked horror films you want to check out this week. Get you ready for Halloween. Colin, we thank you as always. You go polish off the rest of those peanut butter cups.
Okay, my friend.
Thank you, Colin. Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.